Welcome to the Animal Voices radio show here on 102.7 FM Co-op Radio, CFRO in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Today is Friday, April the 13th, 2012. I am your host, Allison Cole, and I'm joined here today by my co-host, Alyssa Ray, and our guest co-host, Robin Piquel, and our control room tech trainee, Tim Aretz. Welcome, everyone, and happy Friday the 13th. Animal Voices is Vancouver's and Western Canada's only animal advocacy and vegan radio program, bringing you all the animal and vegan-related news, events, interviews, lifestyle, and commentary you need to keep you up to date on what's happening both locally and internationally. We at Animal Voices encourage the movement toward a world in which animals are treated with compassion and mercy and are afforded the same rights that humans take for granted. This program can be heard every Friday from noon till 1 p.m. Pacific Standard Time and is also streamed live at coopradio.org and available as podcasts on iTunes and animalvoices.org after airing. For our first main segment today, Alyssa will be presenting Is Fur Eco-Friendly. Alyssa, do you want to just mention a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. I'm just going to talk about, there was a recent ad that was banned in the UK about how it's eco-friendly to wear fur. And this was from the fur breeders, the European Fur Breeders Association. So I'm just going to talk about how it's not actually so eco-friendly and get into all the details there.
Yeah, and for our feature interview, we will have Humane Society International Canada Executive Director Rebecca Aldworth on the show with us to give us an update on the particulars of this year's Canadian seal slaughter, which is taking place now in Newfoundland, and she'll be on the phone with us from Newfoundland to let us know about the latest developments in the seal hunt. For example, it's just been recently announced a few weeks ago that Canada's largest seal fur buyer, Newtan, will stop processing seals. However, another company will now be processing these seals, and the Canadian government has just given them $3.6 million to purchase these dead seals to what amounts to preparing them for stockpiling them in warehouses, since there is no market for them in Canada or abroad. Governmental politics are abound when it comes to making decisions like these regarding the seal hunt, and we'll be learning more about this in this interview coming up in about 32 minutes, so please stay tuned for that. Well, as you may know, Vancouver Cooperative Radio is a listener-supported, not-for-profit organization, and we rely on your kind and generous donations to keep our unique and local programming on the air. Today marks the first day of our spring membership drive, and in fact, today's show marks the first show of the spring membership drive, which means that you get to hear me talk again about why I support Vancouver Co-op Radio CFRO 102.7 FM. So this is my story of why I decided to join and get involved with Vancouver Cooperative Radio. I have been a proponent and supporter of community radio now for a very long time. I've always had a passion for communication and education to the masses and an interest to do so via methods of multimedia, especially including radio. I like the idea of being able to communicate across the airwaves and on the internet via voice. I am a talker by nature, and I feel that it is one of the skills that I may bring to the community to help make this world a better place, that of engaging and informative oral communication. I've also always been a supporter of grassroots efforts in communication and giving a chance for anyone with a voice to make that voice known by whatever media resources available to them, and that's where the benefit of community radio comes in. Unlike the medium of the dominant commercial radio industry, community radio serves a public need that allows information to be dispersed that you may not find in mainstream media. We here at Animal Voices strive to provide you with a diverse and informative package of programming on the issues facing the well-beings of animals today that you're not going to typically find being broadcast by commercial media outlets. Often we present stories and perspectives by those who have worthwhile stories to tell, but who will often be missed by the mainstream media or not given the attention they deserve. There isn't another radio program in the city or even on this side of the country that is dedicated solely to exploring and disseminating the rights of our fellow creatures, and even such programs that do subsist are few and far between. I do feel that there is a need for this type of radio program to exist, and here in Vancouver, we are gracious to have Co-op Radio to fill this need. So we hope that you do appreciate our programming and the mandate of our show, which is to give a voice for those who cannot speak for themselves, and that's the animals. We are volunteers here at Co-op Radio and certainly on the Animal Voices show. The Animal Voices Collective is currently made up of myself, Allison Cole. I'm a co-producer, co-host, and technical operator of the show. Alyssa Ray, who is also a co-producer and co-host. Elon Cohen, a co-producer and co-host. He's not here today. Tim Aretz, our technical operator in training, and a few other generous volunteers who fill in from time to time, such as Robin, who's here today. We all do other things in our lives when we're not here at the station. But Animal Voices draws us together to share knowledge and information on issues that fuel our passions. Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM, is a non-commercial, cooperatively owned, listener-supported community radio station located in the heart of Vancouver's downtown east side. Co-op Radio is a voice for the voiceless that strives to provide a space for underrepresented and marginalized communities. And as I mentioned before, we do rely on donations and membership contributions from our listeners to keep the station running. Each collective of each radio program on CFRO has a responsibility to raise the money needed each year to keep their show on the air. So we really can't do this without you, and we hope you will give whatever you can to show your support for our program. And don't think that it has to be a large amount, because really every little bit helps. If 100 listeners right now gave $5, for example, that's $500 right there, and that amount goes a long way. Or, of course, you can give more than that, be it $20, $50, $100, or more. Another easy option, which will also help a lot, is to take out an ongoing monthly sustaining membership. That is, you have whatever amount you wish regularly withdrawn from your bank account each month to go towards an ongoing membership. This is an especially good option to pursue if you would like to give a little bit each month. So if you did $5 per month, that amounts to $60 a year, which is what I do. And also, if your official membership, or you can call it a donation, it's your financial contribution, as long as you live in Canada, is eligible for an income tax receipt, so it will help out with your taxes as well. Finally, I do encourage you to check out our past shows on our website, animalvoices.org, to read about and listen to some of the great segments we've featured. We really do try to provide a diverse range of rich programming on animal issues, and you will find everything from interviews with Farm Sanctuary's Jean Bauer to Eating Animals author Jonathan Safran Foer to Diet for a New America's John Robbins and to The Cove's Rico Berry. Also informative segments such as On Baking Without Eggs to Travel Tips and Recommendations for Compassionate Eating to Feminism and Veganism. We cover all kinds of animal issues ranging from animals used in laboratory research to animals used in entertainment to animal hoarding to factory farming, and that's just a sampling. We also cover a range of issues pertaining to the vegan lifestyle, since having this lifestyle is the number one most important thing that you can do to help the animals. Please do check out our past shows on animalvoices.org, download our podcasts, and enjoy. I think you will agree that we've got some really good stuff that we're presenting, and not only that, but that it's important information on which to educate the public. Please do support our work not only in spirit, but through a financial contribution as well, either by calling 604-684-8494 now, or by going to cooperadio.org to make an online donation or membership contribution there. So again, that's 604-684-8494. We have Robin answering the phones from now until a half hour after the show, and if the line is busy, please wait a bit and try again, or you can just go to cooperadio.org to make your donation there. And as an additional incentive, we do have some gifts to offer as well to those who donate to Co-op Radio for Animal Voices. For everyone who donates to the show, at least $10 between now and the end of the drive on April 27th, we will put you in a draw for one of five fantastic book titles, of which the winners will have their choice to claim. These books are Kinship and Killing, The Animals and World Religions, Wild Justice, The Moral Lives of Animals, The Happy Herbivore Cookbook, Eat Vegan on $4 a Day, and Becoming Vegan. So please make that call now, 604-684-8494, or donate to cooperadio.org, and making sure to cite Animal Voices as your preferred program, and we'll put you in the draw. Thank you very much for your support.
April 13th through the 27th, join us for 2 weeks of special programming featuring the best that Co-op Radio has to offer. In-depth interviews, alternative music, local arts and culture. Call in, become a member, and join one of Canada's first and longest-running community radio stations. Call 604-684-8494. That's Co-op Radio's Spring Member Drive, April 13th through 27th. Join us.
And now, this is Robin with the events.
So the first event I'm going to talk about is Sunday. This Sunday, it's the 9th Free Market. It's happening from 12 to 4 p.m. at Grandview Park on Sunday, April 15th. So bring your stuff to give away. Take other people's stuff away with you. You don't have to bring anything to take anything. You can enjoy organic produce. That'll be there for free. And you can eat delicious food, not bombs, vegan fare. I know of a couple people that are packing up little veggie seed packages already for it, and I know there's at least one rack of clothing heading down. So, yeah, come to that on Sunday. It's a really fun time. And then I wanted to talk about two bake sales that are coming up, part of the Worldwide Vegan Bake Sale. So the first one is Friday, April 20th. This is Stop UBC Animal Research's baked sale. Stop UBC Animal Research would like to invite you to treat yourself to some delicious vegan baked goodies. And I have to mention that for legal purposes, none of the baked goods will contain THC. However, some may contain hemp. You can find Stop UBC Animal Research at the Art Gallery from 12 to 4 p.m. on April 20th, which I would say is probably the munchiest day of the year, so there'll be lots of hungry people there. The bakers will be carrying baskets filled with baked goods, and all the proceeds will go to Stop UBC Animal Research so they can continue their hard work. If you'd like to bake for the sale, drop-offs are happening on the 19th, which is the day before. And you can contact me if you want. I'm at cracklybam@hotmail.com for more information. The next bake sale is happening Sunday, April 22nd from 2 to 6 p.m. And this is for the Worldwide Vegan Bake Sale as well, hosted by Liberation BC. And they are doing their bake sale at 3G Vegetarian Restaurant, which is 3424 Cambie Street in Vancouver. So this is a little about the vegan bake sale, the worldwide one. From April 21st to 29th, 2012, vegan bakers all over the planet will be taking part in the Worldwide Vegan Bake Sale. On Sunday, April 22nd, we will be holding a bake sale outside 3G Vegetarian Restaurant, and half the proceeds will help local activists involved in the rescue of former battery-caged hens, and the other half will go to Liberation BC. And bakers and volunteers are needed, so you can contact Becky@liberationbc.org for more information. Another event going on soon is the Do No Harm Dog Walk. This is happening on Saturday, April 28th, 2012, from noon to 3 p.m. at Locarno Beach. So this is happening, let me see. It's a walk to raise funds and awareness for both the Humane Seal and Stop UBC Animal Research campaigns. You can make a difference for animals in labs. So this is going to be a vegan picnic and dog walk. So bring your pups or other animals, vegan snacks, frisbees, ukuleles, bring whatever you want. You can walk to win a nice shoes gift certificate, an art print, and the three top fundraisers will receive a 10 cats cartoon, courtesy of gocomics.com. If you want pledge sheets, you can email shamrockstudio@shaw.ca. How are we doing for time? I have a couple more things. There is... Right. This is from Fur Bear Defenders. Saturday, April 28th, you can turn your passion for animals into action. Fur Bear Defenders will be holding a volunteer training day, teaching you the skills you need to make a difference for wildlife. And so this is the same day as the dog walk. Saturday, April 28th, from 2 to 4. It's at the Fur Bear's office, Suite 215, 3989 Henning Drive in Burnaby. Space is limited, so to reserve your spot, please call 604-435-1850. Or email Andrea@furbearerdefenders.com. And there will be awesome refreshments, free cupcakes, and free vegan pizza. So, and you could also win a prize, if you're lucky.
Prizes!
Yay! yeah, if you have an animal-friendly event to announce on the show, you can email us the details at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com or post it on the Facebook page, which is Animal Voices Vancouver.
You are listening to Animal Voices on Co-op Radio. That's 102.7 CFRO, Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Canada. And now I am going to talk a little bit about eco-friendly fur. So recently, an ad was banned in the UK. It says, why it's eco-friendly to wear fur. Fur lasts a lifetime. Naturally long-lasting, fur can be recycled easily and biodegrades. And that was recently banned by the Advertising Standards Authority after they received a complaint from Global Action in the Interest of Animals, or GAIA, which said the ad was misleading. The fur industry, or the European Fur Breeders Association, said that fur is naturally long-lasting, biodegrades, is one of the most ecologically balanced systems in agriculture. And yeah, actually, that was just one attempt. Other bans have been in place for similar ads in Denmark, Holland, Italy, and Finland. They've been ruled false and misleading because the whole life cycle of the garments aren't considered, and they think the Advertising Standards Authority said the campaign didn't show that the fur trade would cause no environmental damage. So I looked into this issue, and I found a lot of interesting details, and I just wanted to kind of go through the facts, and I hope to reveal that fur isn't as eco-friendly as people think. So to appeal to an ever-growing environmental conscience, nearly every industry is painting themselves green. And it's becoming increasingly difficult to tell what is the real deal. It's often meaningless greenwashing, which utilizes unregulated labels to dupe well-meaning consumers. When it comes to fur, what's the truth? The fur industry certainly has some slick campaigns created to divert attention from the issue of animal cruelty and focus instead on the supposed earth-friendliness of fur. Now, the argument for the sustainability of fur is the focus of the Fur Council of Canada's website, furisgreen.com, which is a very well-designed website that's been around since 2007. It has two basic aims. Number one is to appeal to the growing market of eco-savvy consumers. Number two is to deny claims from the sensationalist animal rights activists. Quote, the tagline for the Fur is Green website is an ecological choice in harmony with nature. Oh. And yeah, it's pretty interesting. And they ask in the website, one of the questions in the sort of FAQ section is, how can the use of an animal to make a luxury product ever be ethical? And they, of course, have a very different answer than we do.
Are you going to tell us the answer? I'm curious.
So what I see is this. There's a problem with this mic. There's a sort of desperate attempt here to shift the focus from the animal cruelty and instead focus on sustainability. Before I get into the sort of words they use to sort of greenwash, I did notice one interesting plight on the website. It says, to environmental activists, and they say that you want to buy fur because you can support those that live off the land, and therefore you're, I don't know, supporting sustainability, and somehow that's a once-removed way of being in touch with nature.
How many people live off the land?
Well, that's the thing, is that less than 7%, probably much less, I couldn't find the exact quote, of fur actually comes from Aboriginal sources, and it's not considered really a big moneymaker for them at all. 85% of fur is farmed, and only 15% is wild caught.
What percent of that 7% of those Aboriginals actually live off the land?
Yeah, I can't make a definitive quote on that, but it's not much.
It's such a non-issue for them to actually mention that as a reason, in my opinion.
It is. And so the words they use, sustainable, organic, natural, renewable resource, recyclable, reusable, biodegradable. So first of all, natural. It's pretty much meaningless. Maybe the animal's skin is natural, but certainly not the chemical tanning process. And fur farms combining wild animals, I would say not natural. That's 85% of where fur comes from. As the Fur Bear Defenders, a local action group, points out in their report entitled Fur is Not Green, environmentally friendly is a vague and essentially meaningless term. According to the International Standards Organization, almost any fabric can be reused and recycled, so those words are pretty much meaningless as well. And biodegradable. Now, they say on the website that fur can be composted in your garden. Interesting. Yeah. I'm not a scientist, but I have worked in waste management, and you know, while some things may biodegrade one day, mostly these things like plastic bags and other products that say they're compostable or biodegradable actually need industrial composters to break down with high heat, certain ingredients, and mixing, which does not occur in a landfill. there's not biodegrading. Like, landfills don't turn into compost. And I would not put fir, which has chemical treatment, in my garden.
That's what I was thinking.
What is that
of.
About? And, of course, we must, with any fabric, consider the whole life cycle of the garment, not just the end of life, from source to production and on to the end of life. And I hope to show that when these factors are considered, fir isn't quite what they deem it to be. So before we get to fir farming and the ecological problems associated with that, I just want to talk a little bit about wildlife stewardship or population control, which is one argument that they pose. So the argument is that they're only using surplus animals, that nature creates an overabundance of young, and that not all are expected to survive. They die of hunger and disease, so it's kind of more humane for us to trap and kill them. And they're kind of posing as wildlife management experts, and as the fur bear defenders point out, they have regulations placed on them because if they didn't, they would decimate the populations. And they're acting like they made this up out of the goodness of their hearts, these rules, but they're imposed from the outside.
Whatever happened before this fur industry, like, what were we overrun with animals? What animals are they talking about?
Well, the fur-bearing ones, the ones with the fur that they want.
That's a lot of animals.
It's not like they're just, you know, controlling populations. They are very specifically targeting certain animals whose fur is deemed luxurious. And actually, they say that they're not hunting or trapping for endangered species. They're all abundant species, such as beaver and muskrat. That's over half of the wild catch. But of course, the sad fact is that traps are indiscriminate. An average of 3 non-target animals is trapped for each target animal. That is a staggering statistic. And that means that for a mink coat, that like a 40-inch full-length mink coat, there's 60 mink and also 180 non-target animals.
And that is a staggering statistic. I hadn't heard that before. I think that was a new detail for you as well, right?
Yeah.
It's not something I've even heard in the argument against fur. It's huge. It's like bycatch in the fishing industry. It's huge.
And it says, I got from Liberation BC's fact page on fur that about 5 million non-target animals are caught by steel jaw leg hold traps every year, including dogs, cats, owls, eagles, and various endangered species, such as swift foxes in Alberta, which are near extinction, red wolves, Newfoundland martens, the Canada lynx, and a huge long list, including bald eagles. A big percentage of bald eagles that go into rescue centers have been trapped, like one in five.
Yeah, I wish people were aware of this. Do they want bald eagles and dogs and cats and, you know, to die for their fur?
Yeah. And then on the other end of the population control, there's a couple regions, actually, that are being overrun by invasive species, and I just kind of wanted to mention them. The nutria is a fur-bearing animal around Louisiana, which is supposedly destroying the bayou there. And in New Zealand, the possum is preying on endangered animals, and it has no natural predators. Interestingly, those two animals were actually introduced by fur trappers to bring industry to the area. And now they're saying, we need to create a market for these animals that we have to kill because we're being overrun anyway. So this is eco-friendly. And there's the tagline from the New Zealand, from a New Zealand group called Eco Luxury Fur: all of the luxury, none of the guilt.
Wow.
So I don't know, like, who are they appealing to here? This is, do people who buy fur even have a conscience, first
Melissa,
of all?
What? I guess they're appealing to the people who do have a conscience, who would normally not want to kill animals that, what, should have a life. Isn't that all animals?
Isn't
that all animals?
What is the guilt that they're talking about? Because you're still going to have the guilt about killing animals for your fur.
That's, I guess, what that I think being the bottom overrun line to all this is.
Humans are going to be overrun with these animals if they're not killed.
It's interesting. And apparently, though, those two, they're trying to create markets for those two animals specifically, and they're not very successful. So I want to look now at the environmental problems associated with fur farming, which accounts for 85% of the fur industry. Most of the information I have here is from the Humane Society of the United States report from 2009 called Toxic Fur, the Impacts of Fur Production on the Environment and the Risks to Human Health. First of all, energy consumption. A study at the University of Michigan showed that creating a fur garment takes 20 times the energy it would to make a fake fur garment of the same size. Even a fur coat from a wild animal takes 3 times as much energy.
Wow.
3 tons of feed per coat for a mink coat, and also substantial water and temperature control. And then there's the tanning process. There's toxic chemicals added so the pelts don't rot, and they include formaldehyde, sulfuric, formic, and lactic acids, lead, cyanide, ammonia, chromium salts, etc. All of these things are toxic to the environment and end up in the wastewater. Studies show strong links between tanneries and cancer, either downstream from the tanneries or with the workers themselves. The air pollution, gases from manure, incineration of carcasses, and tannery emissions are all problems. The fur dressing and tanning industry is one of the 5 worst industries for toxic metal pollution to the land. And, of course, the whole industry is fossil fuel driven, from transporting feed to setting and monitoring miles-long trap lines to the tanneries and the storage facilities. And one thing I learned is that the storage of consumer-owned garments is a huge part of the industry. The Fur Council of America encourages fur buyers to store their jackets in the summer in temperature-controlled vaults.
Hmm.
And this is...
I wonder how many people do that.
Well,
the serious fur wearers, I guess.
That's most of the industry for fur is people who have just money to blow and they want to take care of their investments.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned that it's actually a really big part of the income generated. And then there's, of course, the waste. It's one of the biggest issues with all of animal agriculture is what to do with the liquid and solid waste, which includes damaging compounds, nitrogen and phosphorus. In Sweden in 1998, Sweden's biggest fox farm was forced to close due to its role in the contamination of the local water supply. And in Canada's East Coast, mink farms have created an ecological disaster. A local nonprofit, the Association for the Protection of Fur-Bearing Animals, otherwise known as Fur Bear Defenders, and the David Suzuki Foundation report a so-called eco-nightmare in Nova Scotia as a result of the proliferation of mink farms around Yarmouth. So pollution and runoff from the farms has created this terrible overgrowth of toxic and smelly algae, which has rendered local lakes unswimmable and reduced local property values by up to 40%. And it also threatens their watershed. There's an awesome song online called the Mink Stink Song. Nobody's listening. And I encourage listeners to check that out. I don't have enough time to play it today.
Well, we should play that one day, though.
Definitely. Definitely. Finally, there's a quote here, actually, from the Executive Vice President of the Fur Council of Canada, Alan Hershovici. He's been quoted as saying, "You want to help nature, ride your bike to work, put out your blue box, and buy a fur coat."
Wow. That's a pretty grand statement there.
Oh,
in more ways than one.
For real, I'm just going to let that sit there for a minute. So the central argument is that the fur industry is comparing fur, which is quote-unquote natural, to petroleum-based faux furs. And of course, you know, there are other fabrics that are not petroleum-based. And even if they are, you know, sometimes these decisions are difficult to make, but you have to look at, as I said, the whole life cycle. There are more and more innovations. And certain fabrics are better than others, but there's really a lot of problems associated with a whole lot of fabrics, including cotton is one of the worst with water. It can be a difficult decision, and really the best is to buy reclaimed surplus and vintage materials.
Donate your furs to animals and shelters.
Yeah. Anyway, I hope
that was very informative.
I shed some light on that.
Definitely.
Today.
Thanks for that. I just want to remind people that it's our annual spring membership drive happening right now. If you wish to make a donation to Co-op Radio in the name of Animal Voices, please give us a call at 604-684-8494. You can call now or you can call after the show. We'll still be around. And also you can donate on our website, cooperadio.org. And now we have Robin.
You are listening to the Animal Voices Radio Show here on 102.7 FM, CFRO, Vancouver Cooperative Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. And I've got a couple of news bites for us now. I found this one in the Tampa Times yesterday. Broward is a county in Florida, and it's the second county in Florida to pass a no-kill animal policy. So for only the second time in Florida, last week the Broward County Commission took the extraordinary step of endorsing a no-kill policy for their shelters. Broward joins Manatee as the only other county in the state that's working to save the unwanted dogs and cats. Oh, unwanted. They're wanted by someone. So it's been discovered that some shelters that market themselves as no-kill don't actually follow the policies and procedures that would qualify them for that. The Humane Society of Pinellas, a nonprofit shelter, recently abandoned no-kill on its website after the volunteers complained that they had been lying about it or, you know, scuffling the evidence. Mm. And a Tampa Bay Times article revealed that the animals had a 50-50 chance of survival, though many were adoptable. They were killed. So no-kill communities still euthanize animals when they're sick, for example, but they work hard to keep that number down with a goal of 10% or less. That would be a huge improvement, as about 46% of the 7,500 dogs and 67% of the 9,500 cats that come through Broward County currently are euthanized. In its unanimous vote this week to work toward the goal of becoming a no-kill community, the Broward Board of County Commissioners showed courage, visionary leadership, and the willingness to contribute to a positive new paradigm. So awesome. Congratulations, Broward County.
Lovely. And there are a lot of other communities that have adopted no-kill policies and are successful. I haven't done tons of research, but...
Yeah, definitely. Broward is just the latest example,
I'd
say.
That's great.
Yeah, really awesome. Go, Broward. And I've got one more story here. It's from the National Post, and it came out this Wednesday, and it's a letter from Sarah McLachlan condemning the Canadian seal hunt, a letter to Stephen Harper, no one else. So songstress Sarah McLachlan has reiterated her opposition to the East Coast seal hunt in a letter to Prime Minister Stephen Harper. She sent this on behalf of PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, and she's asking him to completely stop defending the industry. She says there's no commerce left in seal furs. The letter was dated April 5th and posted to PETA's website. So here's a couple quotes from it. Now that Russia, which had been buying 95% of Canadian seal fur, has joined the European Union and the U.S. in banning seal fur imports, this business is about as lucrative as an 8-track tape factory. And she also said that it seems the only reason why the federal government defends the dying seal slaughter industry is to control the parliamentary swing seats in Newfoundland and Labrador.
Good for Sarah McLachlan.
I know.
And
hey?
PETA, I mean, as I mentioned before, they did that with Pamela Anderson a couple years ago. I was at that media event where Pamela Anderson actually put her letter into the mailbox for all the news cameras to view. Sarah McLachlan's also a huge proponent for animals. So
totally. Yeah,
good for her.
She's been supporting, I think, the SPCA for years and years. And she wore PETA's Hug Me, Don't Club Me t-shirt during the Canada Day celebrations of Parliament Hill in 2009. And she told CTV News that the sealing industry was perverse and sick. So yeah, she rocks, and go Sarah McLachlan.
Yeah, that's great.
Nice.
Yeah.
I have just one little story that I noticed that was announced in multiple sources that the U.S. vegan population has doubled in just 2 years, according to a new Harris Interactive study commissioned by the Vegetarian Resource Group. The number of vegans in the U.S. has doubled since 2009 to 2.5% of the population. An amazing 7.5 million U.S. citizens now eat a cruelty-free vegan diet that does not include any animal products, no meat, poultry, fish, dairy, or eggs. Close to 16 million, or 5%, identify as vegetarian, never eating meat, poultry, or fish. If this rate continues, vegans will be 10% of the U.S. population in 2015.
That's a huge story.
40% in 2019. 40%.
We are going
80%,
to rule the world. It's 80%
coming. 80% in 2050.
Oh, that's in our lifetime.
My prediction that the world has to be vegan in the next 100, 200 years or so is going to come true. Well, thank you so much for that. Today's feature interview is with Rebecca Aldworth, the Executive Director of Humane Society International Canada. For the past decade, she has been a firsthand observer of Canada's commercial seal hunt, escorting more than 100 scientists, parliamentarians, and journalists to the ice floes to witness the slaughter. She has seen the realities of the hunt and calls upon Canada to prohibit sealing. Rebecca comes to us straight from Newfoundland today, where she is currently situated to observe the 2012 Canadian commercial seal hunt, which is presently in progress. Hello, Rebecca, and welcome to the Animal Voices radio show.
Hi there. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
This year marks a pivotal year for the annual Canadian seal hunt, as news reports indicate that the seal hunt is quickly dying and, in fact, is dead. But sealers are once again out to kill a quota of up to 400,000 seals right now as we speak, and our federal government is still promoting the kill as a sustainable industry for our nation's economy and people. You're an expert on this topic. You are currently in the midst of the seal hunt right now in Newfoundland. Can you please shed some light to our listeners on questions pertaining to the realities of what is happening this year with the slaughter? To start, is the market for seal pelts now non-existent, especially with Russia recently announcing an import ban for seal pelts from Canada?
Yeah, just a few months ago, Russia announced that it had banned harp seal skins, and, you know, that of course is the primary product of the Canadian seal hunt. And Russia was one of the few markets left for the Canadian sealing industry after the European Union banned seal product trade in 2009. So many people in the sealing industry have been really vocal in recent weeks that nobody was prepared to buy seal skins this year, and none of the processing plants were contacting sealers to say that they would. Many of us thought that the hunt might actually not go ahead this year. And unfortunately, the government of Newfoundland stepped in at the very last minute and financed one of the processors to the tune of $3.6 million of taxpayers' money, literally paying sealers to go out there and kill the seals so that their skins could be stockpiled.
So is anyone buying the seal pelts this year at this time, or are they all going to be stockpiled in warehouses, as I've been hearing?
Well, we know from one of the processors, Tamasu is one of the bigger processors in Quebec, and their vice president came out in January and said that right now there are 400,000 skins stockpiled on the global market. We know that when the Russian ban happened, Carina, which is one of the larger processors in Newfoundland, said that they were canceling an order for 100,000 skins this year because of the Russian ban. So, you know, from everything that we can see in the media reports, there are no markets right now for seal products, and it's very clear that these skins are being stockpiled, which, you know, for all intents and purposes, turns the sealing industry into a glorified welfare program.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk to us about the quota set for the seal kill in the past years compared to this year and what the actual numbers met have been?
Well, the quota this year is 400,000 harp seals, and it's the same quota that was assigned last year. 400,000 is the largest quota for harp seals in history, and it's completely unsustainable. Canadian government scientists just a few months ago were advocating for a 25% drop in the quota because of the impact of climate change on harp seals. And if you don't know, harp seals are ice-dependent animals. That means they need the sea ice to give birth to their pups on, and they need the ice to remain intact long enough for the pups to be strong enough to survive in open water. And what's been happening over the past few decades is that sea ice cover every year is diminishing. And in recent years, we've seen up to 100% mortality of the pups born in key whelping areas when the ice is melted too soon. So clearly, climate change is having a serious impact on the harp seal population. But instead of taking action to protect these seals, our federal government is assigning record high quotas and authorizing sealers to kill hundreds of thousands of the surviving baby seals.
Well, I wonder about some of the things I read in the media. The Department of Fisheries and Oceans estimates the population of gray seals is healthy and abundant at 8 million. They say one of the highest levels recorded since the 1950s. The Globe and Mail newspaper recently reported that the seal population is booming. But as you say, reports also indicate that because of global warming, the ice floes are breaking and therefore there are few seals on the ice to be killed. So which of these statements, can you explain the statements that are being made by the others who say that the seal population is alive and healthy, and whether the seals even need to be killed or not for conservation reasons, as is a reason that is being cited. For example, East Coast fishermen say the seal population must be reduced because each seal consumes 1.4 tons of fish a year and threatens the supply available for human consumption.
Well, the first question is about harp seal populations, and there's a few things on that one. First of all, when the Canadian government studies the harp seal population, they survey less than 2% of the breeding sites. So it's a tiny sample, and they use that tiny sample to extrapolate to a population model that is numbering in the millions. We have independent reviews by scientists who've looked at the Canadian government population modeling and said that it poses a risk to seal populations because it's modeling on uncertainty. So the model that they're using has lots of flaws, and we have a very large population estimate coming out of a very small counted sample. The other issue is that the Canadian government consistently says that the seal population has, tripled since the 1970s. We hear that a lot. Mm-hmm. What they don't tell you is that by the 1970s, the harp seal population had almost been wiped out because of overhunting. At the time, senior Canadian government scientists were warning that if all commercial hunting of seals was not stopped for at least a decade, we could lose that population. Now, to put that into context, when that time was happening in the 1970s and the seal population was at risk, they were numbering at 2 million. This is the world's largest population of harp seals. It's supposed to number in the many millions. And it's very easy for a population of marine mammals that is so sensitive to their environment to go from a slight decline to a dramatic decline within the space of just a few years. Now, back in the 1970s, as we've talked about, that population was in serious trouble. That was a result of overhunting that occurred in the 1950s and 60s. So we had a population that was reduced by as much as two-thirds in the space of about a decade. That's how quickly the harp seal population can be at risk. And when you have the added threat of climate change now, a responsible government would do the only logical thing to do and end the commercial seal hunt.
So you're in Newfoundland right now, and I'm curious what you've observed so far with the seal hunt. The official opening day, I believe, was yesterday, but they have been hunting for a bit longer than that. And so I'm wondering, what are you seeing? Are seals being killed? Last year it was 37,000 harp seals out of 400,000. What do you predict for this year, and when does the hunt end?
Well, the seal hunt off the coast of Newfoundland opened in the Gulf of St. Lawrence on the 10th, and it was a few boats that went out from Newfoundland. We counted about six out there. The kill level at last report was around 2,000, so it's a very relatively low number of seals that have been killed so far. What we saw in the Gulf of St. Lawrence is heartbreaking. We had very bad ice conditions in the Gulf this year, yet again. There was very few seal pups remaining on tiny little pans of ice, literally clinging to those pans of ice, and the sealers were going out there and clubbing and shooting to death every surviving pup they found. We had to watch, from the air and document from the air as sealers were clubbing seals, impaling them on metal hooks, even as those seals were still thrashing around. It was the same kind of cruelty that we see each and every year out at the seal hunt. On April the 12th, the seal hunt opened in an area we call the Front, which is the waters northeast of Newfoundland. And unfortunately, we've had a big storm in this area, and our helicopters can't reach the area where the seal hunt is happening. It's our hope that the bad weather has also held back some of the sealing boats and that we won't see a very large number of seals killed over the past day or so. Tomorrow, we will be able to get up to the slaughter, and we will be documenting and exposing to the world what's going on.
And when does the hunt officially end?
This year? It actually only ends in June officially, but in most years, the commercial large vessel quota is taken in just a few days.
Right.
This year, again, I think we're going to see lower kill levels. Many of the sealers are saying that even with that massive government subsidy, the prices that the seal product processors are paying is still too low for them to be even able to cover their costs. We have, on top of that, some pretty bad ice conditions out there, and again, very scattered seal pups, clearly suffering from the impacts of climate change, so not as many seals around as we used to see. And as a result of all those things, I think there's a very good chance that the kill levels will be lower this year, and that's what we're hoping for. You know, in many ways, this subsidy from the Newfoundland government is an admission that the sealing industry is already dead. We have to work so hard this year to make sure that's the case, and that's what we intend to do.
Despite there being no market for seal pelts, and despite the breaking up of the ice flows, our government is still citing the argument of the Hunt's economic need for the sealers of the Maritimes and thus for Canada. Most people don't want to see our fellow Canadians out of work and unable to support themselves, as one might assume might be the case from what they're hearing. And I think that's where some of the support for the Hunt is being directed to. Can you explain to our listeners the reality of the so-called economic viability of the seal hunt, which you have touched upon already, but what are the realities of this industry and the money it provides for our country's economy and the sealers and fishers themselves?
Well, it's very important for people to understand that there is no such thing in Canada as a full-time sealer.
Mm-hmm.
Sealers are commercial fishermen, and on average, those fishermen make more than 95% of their income from regular fisheries like crab, shrimp, and lobster, and less than 5% from killing seals. And in recent years, it's been less than 1%. So this is a very small amount of money, relatively speaking, but in rural communities, and I'm from a sealing community in Newfoundland, I grew up in a sealing town, in those communities, you know, any money is important money, and so we're not trying to underplay, you know, the economic reasons why sealers go out and participate in this hunt. So what we are advocating for is something that will put more money into the pockets of sealers than the seal hunt ever could, and that's a federal sealing industry buyout.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we first came across this idea when we were doing some research on the whaling industry, and we found out that back in 1972, when Canada ended commercial whaling, we compensated whalers for their whaling licenses, and then we invested in economic alternatives. And today, whale watching brings in far more money to our economy and to Newfoundland's economy, frankly, than whale hunting ever did. Now, we think that the seal hunt is in a similar position. We know that the industry is economically non-viable. Global markets for seal products have closed, and regardless of the market situation, climate change means the inevitable end of this industry. What we're hoping is that the federal government will step in now, compensate sealers for their licenses immediately, legislate an end to the commercial seal hunt, and invest in viable economic alternatives in their communities. And that's a solution that is a positive and constructive way for us to move beyond commercial sealing in this country.
Well, I've read that a poll in 2010 revealed that half of Newfoundland sealers have the opinion of supporting the sealing industry buyout. So I just wonder what's holding back the government. Why is the federal government so persistent and so adamantly in support of trying to keep alive this dying and dead industry? For example, they're even trying to gain a market in China now because no one else wants the seals. And you say that it's very clear that political agendas are trumping conservation. What do you mean by that? What are the political agendas at hand?
There are two reasons why the federal government supports the seal hunt, and unfortunately, neither of them is very honorable. The first one is that seals make a terrific scapegoat for the fisheries mismanagement that's been going on for many years. So the federal government has essentially mismanaged virtually every fishery that exists on the East Coast into near commercial extinction or commercial extinction. And seals are a very handy scapegoat. You talked earlier about seals and fisheries interactions and about how fishermen are saying that seals are eating lots of fish. Well, the reality is that there are tens of thousands of interdependent species in the ocean, and the largest predator of fish is other fish, not marine mammals of any kind. But because seals do eat fish, you know, the federal government has pointed to them again and again and again and tried to indicate that fishery fisheries collapses and lack of recovery of fish stocks is somehow related to seal populations. That is absolutely untrue. And in fact, seals are opportunistic feeders, and they eat lots of different kinds of fish, including many important predators of the fish stocks that are commercially targeted. They're beneficial for the ecosystem. So that's the first thing. The federal government likes to scapegoat seals for fisheries mismanagement. But the other issue is that supporting the seal hunt politically is a cheap way to look like you're doing something to help Atlantic Canada. But truly, it does absolutely nothing to address the economic issues in coastal communities. If you look at the sealing industry, even at its height, when it was earning more money than it ever has in history, it was less than 3% of the value of Newfoundland's fishery, and less than 1% of Newfoundlanders worked in the industry. This industry, even if it were booming, could never begin to address the economic problems that are faced in coastal communities in Canada. So to address those problems would take a much greater financial investment than throwing a few million dollars at the sealing industry. But by politically supporting the sealing industry, federal parties look as though they're standing with Atlantic Canadians. And unfortunately, nothing could be farther from the case.
Well, I'm wondering about the rest of Canada. Isn't it true that most Canadians are against the seal hunt and they are the majority of voters? Is that not the case?
That is the case, and not just Canadians as a whole, but we did some polling in Newfoundland last year, and we found out that 72% of Newfoundlanders would support a prohibition on killing seals under 3 months of age. Now, 98% of the seals that are killed are less than 3 months old. In fact, most of them are just about a month of age or less when they're killed. So in reality, 72% of Newfoundlanders oppose the seal hunt as it exists today and support a move that would effectively shut it down. A further 8% of Newfoundlanders oppose all commercial sealing, regardless of the age of the seal. So it's clear that even in Atlantic Canada, people have very strong feelings about this issue and are very much prepared to move beyond the seal hunt. We think that given sealers are already indicating they're in support of a buyout, Atlantic Canadians are clearly in support of moving beyond commercial sealing, and Canadians as a whole have expressed very strong opposition to the seal hunt for decades. It's time for the federal government to start listening and come up with a better and more constructive solution to move all of this forward.
It really surprises me and shocks me about some of the things that I hear what the government is saying about the hunt. For example, our Prime Minister Stephen Harper has said, our government will continue to vigorously defend this humane and highly regulated industry and to seek new international markets for Canadian seal products, including China. What does he mean by this? How can he use the word humane? I'm confused.
Well, I think you can only use that word because I'd be willing to bet a lot of money that Stephen Harper has never actually observed the seal hunt himself.
He needs to go on YouTube and look at some videos.
Yes, exactly. But, you know, I mean, this is my 14th year out here, and it never gets any easier to watch this. It's unbearable. We have very young, defenseless animals that are being forced to comprehend a level of cruelty, to endure that cruelty, that most adult people can't bear to stand to watch on videotape. You know, it's horrific being up here, to be frank. It's awful. But we know that if we're not here, if our cameras are not rolling, what happens to these seals goes on in secret, and that's exactly what the Canadian government wants. It's through showing the world what happens up here, by bringing veterinarians up to the ice floes to see it and write reports on it, that we expose what's happening to these seals. Now, to be clear, the seal hunt involves a huge level of suffering, but that's not because sealers are horrible people who enjoy inflicting pain and suffering on seals. It's because they're working in an environment that completely prevents application of humane slaughter methods. We're talking about a hunt that happens very far offshore in gale force winds, high ocean swells, low visibility, extreme low temperatures, and accuracy in both clubbing and shooting is almost impossible under those circumstances. And for that reason, veterinarians are saying that this industry is inherently inhumane. It cannot be made humane. So if it can't be made humane, then as a civilized society, we have to make a choice. And that choice has got to be to end the seal hunt and find a better way forward for everybody involved.
So finally, will the seal hunt be back next year? And what can concerned people do to have it over and done with?
The most important thing that Canadians can do right now is to get in touch with their federal representatives and tell them that they support a buyout of the sealing industry. They can do so by visiting hsicanada.ca. There's lots of forms that people can fill out online to send to their political representatives to support the buyout plan. This is a really important part of it. Stephen Harper needs to know that Canadians are willing to put their money where their mouth is and support a way out of the commercial sealing industry. So that's one really important thing that people can do. But we have about 10 things that Canadians can do, all listed on our Take Action page, and we hope everybody will take all of those actions. This is going to be a critical year. You know, they say the toughest mile to run is the last in any race. This is our race to save the seals. This is our last mile, and this is going to be the fight of our lives this year. We can end this. I am absolutely certain that we can. But if we don't end it this year, we'll spend the next five decades fighting it. We have to work harder than we ever have and shut this thing down for good.
Thank you so much, Rebecca, for not only taking time out of your day in Newfoundland, but for shedding so much light on the issue of the annual Canadian seal slaughter and giving us the most up-to-date information on the subject. To find out more facts about the seal hunt, as Rebecca said, you can visit HSI Canada's website at hsicanada.ca. Thanks so much, Rebecca. Take care.
Thank you.
You are listening to 102.7 FM CFRO Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Canada. We'd love to hear from you. We welcome your feedback and urge you to keep in touch. Drop us a line, radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. Join our community on Facebook, Animal Voices Vancouver, or follow our tweets at Animal Voices YVR. Our awesome blog and website is animalvoices.org. To get our latest shows automatically, subscribe on iTunes. Speaking of, there's videos on our website, and we have a great one up there today related to the feature I did today on eco-friendly fur. There's an awesome animated short up now, which was produced by the Humane Society of the U.S. about the environmental dangers of fur. It's really easy to understand. Next week, Friday, April 20th, Alon Cohen will be presenting his first episode of the show. He'll be featuring an interview with Vasile Staniscu, a PhD candidate in the Program of Modern Thought and Literature, on his work entitled Green Eggs and Ham, The Myth of Sustainable Poultry and the Danger of Local, in the works of Michael Pollan, Barbara Kingsolver, and Joel Salatin.
Should be really interesting.
Everyone, yeah, I'm really excited to discuss the popular authors and dissect the ethics of the locavore philosophy. One final friendly reminder that it's time to pledge your support to keep this show on the air.
It's time.
We'll be answering the calls until 1:30 today, so don't delay. A few dollars goes a long way towards broadcasting the voices of animals who can't speak for themselves.
604-684-8494.
Stay tuned to Co-op for Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith. We'll leave you with a song called Cold as Ice by Melissa Van Fleet. If you buy the song on iTunes, proceeds go straight to the Humane Society's Protect the Seals organization.
Soft as the falling snow. And tears don't have a chance to hit the ground below. Innocent dark eyes staring back at you while wishing and praying for harmony. It's so look